now I want to welcome Ray up here, our speaker tonight.
My name's Ray. I'm an alcoholic. My last name's McGee, if you need to know it. I don't care. It's a pleasure to talk. And, when I was, you don't think about these things until like maybe yesterday. And then I think, oh shit, it's tomorrow, And so here I am, and it's the 4th of July, and I'm standing in front of you, and I can remember a 4th of July, a dreadful 4th of July. It was 1976. It was the bicentennial, 200 years. And there were all kinds of celebrations, and there was a big deal about the bicentennial. I lived in a wonderful old neighborhood in St. Paul, Minnesota. And it was a little neighborhood tucked away, and big houses, big old homes built in the 1880s, I guess. And old families and lots of young kids. And this little neighborhood, there was two blocks long. And I lived on the edge of it. And somehow I had gotten included with those neighbors, I don't know just how, being what I was. And the 4th of July, every year, and I thought about them today because they've done this for over 100 years, they've had this 4th of July. Big dinner at the end of it, and there'd be a parade, and there'd be races, and all this in this little neighborhood. And there'd be a bunting thing with somebody off here giving a 4th of July speech, and it was always a heartfelt. It was like it should have been a cover of the Saturday Evening Post or something like that. And so I had gone to the celebration for some good reason. I don't know why. I was a part of that neighborhood, and they accepted me and let me do this. And I was drinking so much. And it was time for the dinner, and it was always a big dinner. Special meats, fish and lobster flown in or whatever. And I ate, and I knew I needed to go home, and I went home. And I got in the living room. I was drunk. And I turned the TV on, and it was the 4th of July, 200 years, and there was New York Harbor, the fireworks, and there was the fireworks in Washington, D.C., and I'm sitting there, oh my God, I was filled with passion, kind of thing. And I started to cry. And I couldn't stop. And there I was, drunk, sitting in my living room, just sobbing, crying, thinking, you gotta stop. They're coming to pick you up in 10 minutes to go to the fireworks at the Capitol, which we walked down the street to the Capitol. You gotta stop. I was breaking. I was cracking open. I didn't know it. I was just scared. I didn't want them to see me that way. I'd rather have them see me drunk out there, whatever. I didn't want them to see me broken into pieces. And so I sat there, and I did get myself put together. And they came and got me, and I went to the fireworks. And I think I enjoyed them, but of course I was drunk. And I came home and I went to bed. And that was July 4th, 1976. It was 50 years ago today. And there I was, an absolute basket case. I didn't tell anybody, I didn't let anybody know. But something had broken, and I was truly, truly interested in what's happening inside Ray. Okay? I was 37 years old. was going to be 38 in October. And I got up the next day and I did what we always do. You go back to work and you put your tie on and you go back to work. And you don't tell anybody what happened. God, no, you're not going to tell anybody what happened, because what might be happening, I didn't know. I didn't know. Maybe I was cracking. Maybe I was breaking down. Maybe I was going into some mental state. Maybe I was going to the hospital. I didn't know. So I was working on a political campaign for a friend, neighbor, and they were making yard signs, and it was happening in my backyard, and people would gather. I couldn't do much. I could make sandwiches, and I could open beers. And so my kitchen was right there, so I'd make the sandwiches, and I'd open the beers. I'd take them out and give them a beer and give them a sandwich. And a young man was there, and he'd take a sandwich. He never took a beer. I was trying to be hospitable. Come on, John, don't you want a beer? No, I don't. And finally, I was a little bit pissed, you know? Why doesn't he accept my hospitality? And I said, not too nicely, I'm afraid, why don't you ever take a beer? I'm trying to be generous and helpful here. And he said, I don't drink anymore. Anymore. I can sometimes look back and I think, and that's the word that saved my life. Anymore. And I said, what do you mean anymore? He said, well, I used to. But I go to AA and I don't drink anymore. I acted like I didn't hear him. I didn't want him to know. You know? Really? No. Oh, Mr. Cool zipped my lip and acted like I hadn't heard a thing. And I went home that night and I knew somebody who went to AA and didn't drink anymore. Quite by accident. So we went on. That was in July and August. And went to work. I was successful in what I did. I'm a social worker, and worked in a child guidance center, and I had developed some ideas about a self-esteem development in kids, and they were flying me all over the country to give talks at conventions and conferences and workshops and that kind of thing. And so I had this kind of, you know, life of airports and and hotel rooms and getting up and catching the plane then the next morning. It wasn't very glamorous. It sounded good, but it wasn't very nice. It was a lonely, lonely time. And it might have been lonely because of some other things that were going on in my life. I'm not sure. But anyway, I was doing all of that and going around the country and doing these things and airports and hotels. Tried not to drink in airports because you know how that is. You come close to missing a flight and then acting like it wasn't my fault, you know. So anyway, one night, it was in October, later that year, I was sitting in a neighbor's. I'd come home. I'd poured a good heavy whiskey and a little bit of ice. I was at the neighbor's for some business thing. I was sitting there, and in the course of the conversation with my glass in my hand, I said, I'm going to have to do something about my drinking one of these days. And these were people who loved me. And they did it right. They didn't jump in and say, yeah, you've been making an ass of yourself all over. No, they didn't say that. I said, I've never heard you say anything like that before. I'd never said anything like that before. The old boy was cracking. And they said, I've never heard you say anything. I said, I never have. And I went home, and I sat in my chair, and the whiskey was out, and the ice was out. And I didn't pour a drink. And I called that guy, John, who never would take a beer, and said, I need some help. And he took me the next night. He took me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting in St. Paul, Minnesota. We walked up the steps of this big old house. It was a big house. And there was a big foyer. And it was just, you know, you walk into one of those rooms, it's just chatter, chatter, chatter. And I didn't know anyone. I wasn't going to chatter with anybody. I was here on serious business, thank you. And then all at once it was 8 o'clock and the bell rang and they surrounded the room and stood there and we said a prayer and did that. And then everybody started to identify themselves. My name's Rhea. My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Mary. I'm an alcoholic. It's going around the line. And it's coming closer and closer. And I don't know, some of you undoubtedly have had that panic feeling. What am I going to do? What am I going to do? And it got to me. And I said, my name's Ray. And I'm an alcoholic. And they said, welcome, Ray. And I've never had a drink since. Never had a drink since. It's 49 years and 9 months later. See, I keep track of when this 50's coming. I'm looking forward to that. Watch out, folks. Watch out. I had a friend here this past week who has six months more than I have. I've been chasing him. I've been trying to get him to take a drink for 49 and a half years. And he has 50 now. He got it just a few, couple months ago. And he's just an ass about it, you know? I have 50 years, you know? I want him to have 50 years. And I don't want him to take a drink. And I don't want you to, and I don't want me to. And all of us who don't know, who don't do very well at doing it, oh, I hope we don't have to take a drink. The most important bit of information that I know is that my name's Ray McGee and I'm an alcoholic. And I need to keep that out in front of me and I have to remember that dangerous ledge I got close to. I was ready to step over the edge into a life that I didn't want to have anything to do with. So the 4th of July, 50 years later, is still an important day to me. That day I came home, that day the veneer cracked, the day I was sitting in front of a goddamn television crying. God, and then I can tell you, I'm not afraid to tell you that that day I cracked. Oh, Ray cracked. So I'm going to go back a little bit now. I was born in a little town in South Dakota. A little town, 254 people. We knew how many there were. We kept track. I went to school in the same building for 12 years. My parents had gone to school in the same building for 12 years. And they had both gone off in 1931. My dad went off to engineering school and my mom went off to nursing school. And times were terrible. It was the Great Depression coming on and they couldn't finish. They each had 3 years and they couldn't go back. There was no money. And they always thought they were going back, but then they got pregnant. And my mother was pregnant. They did what you did. They got married in my grandma's and grandpa's living room. I've always known the people who were there. And they raised three of us in that little town with two sets of grandparents, aunts, uncles, cousins, 254 people, half of them were related. Yeah, we had a little business in that little store. We thought it was as big as any place in the world. And I went to school in that same building that my parents went to school in for 12 years. My brother went, my younger brother went there. My older brother graduated and went off to school of engineering and became an engineer. And I graduated and they just fed it to us in our potatoes or some such thing because we never ever made a decision we were going to go to college. We just grew up knowing we were going. And we didn't have the money. We had to work. We had to do those things. I went, and then my little brother trailed along. They both became engineers. And I was a teacher. I was a teacher. I taught a little school. It had to be 360 miles away from anybody I knew. That was my qualification for finding a school to teach in, because I was drinking too much and I was making an ass of myself way too often, and I didn't want anybody to know. So 360 miles away, I found a little German community in Iowa, in the state of Iowa. And, they drank like fish. They just drank like fish. And I lived with an old couple in their house. And the day I arrived, the older gentleman introduced me to the house and showed me my room. He took me down in the basement and he said, "And here's a refrigerator that we just keep beer in." And he poked aside a curtain and said, "And this is where we keep the whiskey." He said, "And you just drink as much of it as you want and have your friends in, because we love to have young people in our house." It was a buck a day with my breakfast and all the liquor I could drink. I stayed for 4 years. And by the time the 4 years were up, I remember one day at the country club, at the golf tournament, I was standing on the table telling dirty stories that nobody should be telling anywhere. And I thought, I guess it's about time you think about moving on. I'd actually thought about it a few months before. And the president had been assassinated, and that was a terrible time for us, you know. And I was sitting in the living room, drunk, watching the Kennedy assassination follow-up stuff, crying, and I thought, I gotta do something. So I applied to Washington, D.C. for the Peace Corps, and right away they accepted me. And they shipped me off to Africa, and I lived in the jungle for 2 years. And I thought, you know, that should be good for my drinking. I can't get it, you know. But I got to my little jungle house out in the middle of the jungle. It had a light bulb, but it didn't have much electricity. Sometimes there was a generator that was on, and then I could have light. But most of the time it was a kerosene lamp. I sat out there and I'd get my limes off the tree and I'd get my liquor, and I'd go to the missionary would take me to the Firestone store, and that's where you bought your supplies. And I'd put the whiskey bottles in the bottom of the boxes, you know, and then I'd pile all my groceries on top, because I didn't want her to know she was running whiskey, you know. And I'd sit out there and I'd drink too much. I'd get drunk. I'd go to town on the weekends. I'd wrap my clothes in a cloth and go sit by the road until somebody picked me up. I was a white man for miles. I'd go to town and I'd get drunk again. Oh. And I thought, well, this isn't working very good. I stayed there for 2 years. I thought about re-upping. And I thought, no, you better do something else. So I applied to graduate school, and lo and behold, I only had enough money for one application. So I applied to the University of Minnesota, and they accepted me. And they gave me a stipend that covered my tuition and fees for 2 years. All my living expenses, my tuition and fees for 2 years. I mean, I don't know how I got lucked into something like that. And so I got a graduate degree. I did well. I was favored by the faculty. I went off. I had a master's degree in social work. Went to work for a child guidance center. Did things that were exciting to do, and got me some exposure. I flew all over the country giving these speeches and things. Wearing a button that said, "I like myself." My boss made me wear that button that said, "I like myself." I hated him. I hated him. I'd throw the thing off, and he'd see me throw it and back into my office, and he'd say, "Do you have your button on, Ray?" And I'd say, "Oh, I forgot. I'd have to pin it on." I got downtown one day in Minneapolis, going into a big business building, 40 stories tall. I got in the elevator, a crowded elevator. I had my button on. I didn't know it. Everybody just you know, I'm not standing anybody by anybody that has a button on that says they like themselves. I didn't very much. That's why I hated the button so much, I guess. But the button wormed its way into my brain. And then there was that night, and the guy said, I don't drink anymore. I go to AA. And I acted like I didn't hear. But who did I call? He took me into that big meeting, and I said out loud, my name's Ray, and I'm an alcoholic. Probably the most profound statement that ever came out of my mouth. So here I am. I've had the rare opportunity to put my lives in the lives of many other people and watch what can happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. We have the best show available to us anywhere you ever go. You know, how do I say this? I love the Alano Club in Minneapolis, in San Luis Obispo. And you know, and I go to Melody and I do that, and I can go to any meeting I want, but man, the Alano Club in San Luis Obispo, you see some rare ones. You see some, when I say rare, I mean red and bloody, you know, kind of thing. They're raw. And then you see the light come on. And you see the miracle. And you see it happen. And you can be a part of it. And you can knock him on the shoulder and say, I see ya. Or you can kick him in the butt and say, God darn it, you're doing something special today. This is exciting. And he doesn't know yet that it's exciting. You know, we don't catch on right away. We don't. I shouldn't say that. Maybe we do catch on right away. I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was so excited about it. And I had done this, and they told me to come back. They were going to let me come back. They made a special point of asking me to come back. I never miss. And these days, that was when we had one. We went to one meeting a week. Most people went to one meeting a week. Thursday night was my night, and for years, that was it, a Thursday night. It was enough to keep me sober. I made some friends. I spent some time with those friends. I still went back to that church where I sat in that pew where I had heard that man who started this thing for me. And I kept going back, and it was enough. Now, I saw those people other places, and I did that, but I thought one meeting a week was it. I came out to California. I came out just to visit some friends and who had just moved here, and I ended up coming back for a month. I was in Cayucas. Cayucas, one meeting a week. Well, I thought that was just fine. And then I decided to go take a little side trip one day, and I went into Morro Bay and I went to Harbor Lights. Well, my God, they have a meeting every noon at Harbor Lights. And so pretty soon I was going to five meetings a week, you know. And you know, I bet this last week I went to 17 meetings. People say, you don't need to go to that many. I don't know, I don't need to go to it, but don't tell me how many meetings I get to go to. I get to go to as many meetings as I want to, and I want to go there, I want to watch the miracle, I want to think that I might have a part of the miracle, and I want the miracle to happen to me. Yes, I go, and I love going. I'm an old single man, I'm gay. That wasn't a word when I was young, okay? Out on the South Dakota prairie, we didn't say anything like that. You'd probably end up dead in the corner of a, you know, we've seen the movie about it. So I was a big secret. My parents were just sure I wasn't. And I was kind of coming to the realization that, yeah, I think I might be. But that was the big secret. I could never, ever be honest. And let anybody know who I was. And that was a big thing. I came to AA and I was this big thing. That was just, And finally, one night, I went into my meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew this was the meeting I might not ever get to go back to again. And very, very, I'm going to say very bravely, because it took some bravery to do it, I said, you know, I never talk about this, but I'm a gay man. they just laughed. They said, did you think we didn't know? There I was, all wiped out, twisted out of shape about this whole thing. And they had known all the time, and they just didn't give a damn, you know? I was a sober man working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, experiencing the miracles that can happen, experiencing the joy. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm the lucky one. I go to lots of meetings. I speak a lot. I'm not real good at sponsoring. I don't know quite how to do that like I think I'm supposed to do. I do it. One of my sponsors was as here. He has 50 years of sobriety. I started sponsoring him about 12 years into his sobriety when it didn't matter that he had more time than I had, I guess. You know, and I've sponsored many over the years, but it's not something that I've been particularly comfortable about. I love carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous out into the world. I'm one of those who's not afraid to say I'm an alcoholic and I'm in recovery. And I believe in Alcoholics Anonymous like I believe in nothing else. I'm not afraid to say that. I'm not afraid to do that because it is so much the fact that I don't have any sense of embarrassment about it. My parents were always kind of, you know, I'd go home to visit and they'd kind of let me know that maybe we don't talk about that openly, you know. My mother might have told one of her sisters, as if these people hadn't observed. You know, they didn't go off in the corner and get drunk, or I wouldn't go off in the corner. I'd get drunk right in front of them and make people uncomfortable. And I didn't do that anymore. No, Alcoholics Anonymous has transformed my life. I live a life of AA. I'm glad I do. I believe in a God that led me to this program and helps transform me. God, we got a lot of time left. We might get out early tonight, folks. But so here I am. What are the big things? I had a lot of education. 19, 20 years of schooling. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to find the stuff I needed to really put my life together. I've never hesitated being a single man. I've never hesitated about saying I'm in AA. Sometimes people do, and I understand it, but I haven't had that. And so my friends, I have had friends who have been embarrassed or kind of edgy because they're afraid I'll say something about it in front of someone that they don't want them to know that they're alcoholic. So I have to shut up. And I think I have a pretty good sense about that. But it's not something I want to keep a secret about. We have something that happens to us here that allows us to have lives that we never would have had. We'd either be dead or miserable. I don't have that anymore. I live by myself. I've always had dogs. My last dog was a dud. It was a rescue and it had no affection for me. I was really glad to put her down. That's never happened in my life. Thank God she was old and feeble, this little thing, you know. And absolutely, she just was not a nice dog. I rescued her. But anyway, I can't walk a dog anymore. I can't do that kind of thing. So I went off to the shelter and I got myself a cat. I got myself a kitten. Never had a kitten in my life. Never had a cat in my life. I got this little calico cat. I named her Hobbs. She's a girl. She's fixed. She shouldn't have a boy's name, but I liked Hobbs better than any other name. So I named her Hobbs. And Hobbs just takes care of me in a way that I find so magnificent. You know? That little cat, she just keeps me alive. She keeps me alive. She makes me want to get up in the morning. She's there standing on my head, you know, like, it's about time, you old gizzard, you buzzard. But I was thinking about it today. I left the picnic. I was tired. I've had company for a week, and I just was exhausted. And I left the picnic early. I had eaten, and I went home. I got on the bed, and I just went to sleep. I slept for 3 hours this afternoon. And I wake up, and the cat's just laying beside me, purring away. I have good company in my house. Yeah, I do. And I don't have to bitch or whine, and I don't have to be scared. I have a good spiritual program that's greatly enhanced by the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, sometimes we hear it's a spiritual program, but we never really ever think too much about that. But it's a spiritual program. I wouldn't do it if I didn't have some kind of a belief in a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. That just doesn't come if we don't sit here and do some work. And I'm going to be 88 in the fall. And that's getting old. And I'm not scared. And someday I won't wake up. Someday I won't feel good or something. I don't know what's going to happen. I've had a heart attack. I've had a stroke. I've had cancer. I had a stroke a few years ago on the 4th of July at the picnic. At the picnic. And I thought I just was overheated. And I sat on a bench, and I was sitting there. A woman was sitting next to me, and she was a nurse. And somebody said, "Ray's turning red," or something, I don't know what. And the woman looked, and she said, "He's having a stroke." And they called the ambulance, and they hauled me off, and they got me fixed. And I've not had any of that since. And I've had cancer, and I've had those things. But I don't know. I take good care of myself. You know, we all take better care of ourselves sober than we did drunk. I mean, I eat decent. And I sleep well. And I treat myself. And I don't let myself... those thoughts of anger and that kind of thing. We don't live the same. We are transformed people. And I want you to think of that in the most positive way. There's been a transformation in me. What is that transformation? Well, it's not hard to go home and make a list of things that you do, think, or feel today that weren't happening when we were guzzling, you know? We didn't, you know? I used to not wake up. I came to. Are there any others in this room that just came to and not wake up? Yeah, I think so. There's some heads shaking. That's what it's about. You know, so we are the lucky ones. We are the lucky ones. You hear that sometimes, and you think, oh, that's a little bit trite. Some of those things are not trite. They're just maybe the biggest fact in the world. There are people in this room that have known me for a number of years, and I hope they think of me as somebody who is happy and filled with some gratitude and able to show it. You know, we got to find ways to show it. We got to find ways to acknowledge strengths in our fellows. And sometimes praise isn't the way we do it. Sometimes we do it with a wink. Sometimes we do it with a click of the finger. Sometimes we do it with a sock in the arm or a kick in the butt that said, I saw that. I like that. That's good. And when you get those things, they're powerful. They're rich. So, you know, here we come and we build new lives. We truly build new lives. For the newcomers who are in the room, I want to say keep coming back. Because there's some magical stuff that's out there just waiting to happen in your life. And it can happen. We do not come here and do what they say and have a worse life. We come here and hopefully do what they say. And our life opens up to a kind of richness, a new kind of knowledge, a new relationship with the God of our own understanding. Yeah, that's what happens here. And I want to say, we are the lucky ones. Thank you for your attention. Is that my name?
Give Ray another round of applause, man. Yeah.